Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the opening address from the 2015 Australasian Aid Conference by Deputy Opposition Leader and Opposition Spokeswoman for Foreign Affairs and International Development, Tanya Plibersek.
Well, thank you, Gordon. As Stephen said, my name is Ian Young, and I've got the very great honour to be Vice Chancellor of the Australian National University. Can I add my welcome to everybody to the Crawford School of Public Policy and to the ANU? The Development Policy Centre and the Asia Foundation have put in an enormous amount of work to actually make this conference happen. These things don't just happen by accident. So I'd like to particularly acknowledge and congratulate the organisers for all of that hard work to put this important meeting together. It's also very heartening to see such a tremendous turnout here and to also see the enormous work and research which is going into this extremely important field. There are some other very important acknowledgements I need to make, and these are to the Harold Mitchell Foundation and to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who have been tremendously generous in their ongoing support for the Development Policy Centre. Their work wouldn't happen without that tremendous philanthropic support which occurs. As Stephen said, this is the second Australasian Aid Conference, and we're tremendously pleased by the increasing interest and the growing numbers of people who are obviously very interested in being able to participate in this sort of discussion. I had the great pleasure of welcoming the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Julie Bishop, to open the first of these conferences a year ago, and it's my very great pleasure today to welcome the Deputy Leader of the Opposition and Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Development, Tanya Plibersek, to deliver her opening address in just a few moments. We're delighted that the Shadow Minister has agreed to open this conference. Representing the federal electorate of Sydney since 1998, Ms Plibersek served in both the Rudd and the Gillard governments as Minister for Health, Minister for Human Services and Minister for Housing. In 2013, Ms Plibersek assumed the role of Deputy Leader of the Opposition as well as Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Development. She has already made a significant mark in these new roles and has developed a particular interest and particular passion for international development. Today we have an opportunity to hear her and presumably Labor's vision for the Australian Aid Program. Ms Plibersek, thank you very much for taking time to be able to deliver the address today and also to take some questions following your address. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tanya Plibersek.
Thank you, Ian, for that welcome, and thank you also, Gordon Heim, for your words earlier. I'd also like to acknowledge Professor Stephen House and say how pleased I am that you've been able to put on this conference. I've read some of the papers from the last conference, and I think gathering together so many people to talk about such an important issue will certainly be beneficial for all of us. I want to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on today and pay my respects to their elders past and present. I've got a slightly shorter time frame than I thought I would have today because, as you all know, these as Kirsten Livermore would know better than most, parliamentary sitting days are a little unpredictable, and a motion's been brought on this morning for discussion at just after 10 o'clock. We have a motion about Andrew Chan and Muireann Sukumaran and the death penalty. So you'll understand that I won't have quite as long for questions at the end of my words because, of course, I have to be there to talk about that. Every now and again, something goes viral on the internet. It's a funny story. Sometimes someone gets injured. Usually there's a cat involved. But a few weeks ago, a story went viral from the BBC. You might have seen it. It was about a 90-year-old Kenyan grandmother who went back to school. She was born when Kenya was still British occupied. She'd never had the opportunity for a formal education. This remarkable woman had spent 65 years as a midwife and indeed had delivered many of the kids that she was going to school with. She enrolled to go to school to be an example to other women, particularly young mothers who dropped out of school. And she said, "I want to say to the children of the world, especially girls, that education will be your wealth. Don't look back and run to your father." It's a great story. It's got lots of feel-good factors, and you can see why it was shared so widely, especially when you get to the bit where she's still delivering babies, often in the dormitory she shares with her great-granddaughter. And it reminded everyone who saw it or read about the story about the power of education, its power to create opportunities, to ignite aspirations, to transform lives, and the hunger for education amongst those who've been denied it. That transformative power of education to create the preconditions for individuals and nations to rise out of poverty is why the second Millennium Development Goal is to achieve universal primary education. Of course, the not-so-feel-good part of that BBC story is that while in many places that goal has been achieved or is close to being achieved, in sub-Saharan Africa, that's not the case. And what hasn't gone viral, in fact, what's sunk without a trace, is the fact that the Abbott government's first budget cut aid to sub-Saharan Africa by more than half, cut $118 million out of what had been a $224 million program under Labor. Plan International estimates that the international development cuts mean that in the next year alone, 220,000 girls will be denied a chance to enrol in school. We've been told just in the last few days that a program to help girls go to school in Uganda has been cut. Two programs we've heard that were to start in Timor and Bangladesh to help young people prepare and enter the workforce, cut. The Fred Hollows Foundation was forced to axe programs in Indonesia, China, Vietnam, and parts of Africa. Australians are a generous people, as the public response to disasters and crises shows. And you see that around the world. Australians are not alone. Even in countries where there's a debate between political parties about the scale and the scope of official development assistance, what you see is a large majority of people still support the basic idea of bringing food to the hungry, medicine to the sick, education to those who've been denied it, and hope to those who otherwise have none. Our fellow Australians are not the only ones who have an inherent understanding of a truth that the current government seems unable to grasp. In a globalised world, we are all connected, and not just in a vague sort of no man is an island sense, but by economic links, by trade, travel and cultural exchange, we are all linked. When vaccination programs eliminate communicable diseases, we are all healthier. When nations become markets for our goods and supply us with their own, we are all wealthier. And when education levels rise and skills expand, we may not all be more wise, but we all reap the benefits of innovation, invention, and creativity. While support for aiding others is and remains strong, support for foreign aid as an abstract concept, divorced from specific crises, needs, and goals, has become more tenuous. For a period, the Make Poverty History campaign successfully drew a direct connection about what government could do, investment in foreign aid, and addressing the ills that people face. There was a powerful consensus built between citizens, NGOs, and governments. But no consensus is permanent. It must be renewed and rebuilt on a constant basis. And if there's one thing that politics has taught me, it's that no victory is final, no cause is ever over, and public support can never be assumed. When it comes to international development, we've seen old caricatures about waste and bureaucracy, inefficiency and corruption once again exploited, both here and overseas, as that clear connection between our aid and the good it does slides out of the public eye and fades from people's minds. And in Australia, with the destruction of the bipartisan approach we've seen in the last couple of years, we've seen that consensus dwindle. When we were in government, we nearly doubled the Australian aid budget, and we were working towards reaching the 0.5% goal by 2017-18. The Liberals have cut $11.2 billion from the Australian aid program. They've cut at every budget and the two financial updates since they were elected, and they've walked away from that bipartisan target of 0.5% of GNI that was first signed up to by John Howard. The Australian Council for International Development has calculated that this means Australian aid is the lowest percentage of our gross national income since records began in 1954. In the last budget, 20% of all of the cuts in that budget, $1 in every $5 that was cut, came from this single program. But those numbers, people find it hard to contemplate billions of dollars and what billions of dollars buy. They mean 1.5 million children could be born without a birth attendant, or 2.2 million children won't get to enrol to go to school, or 3.75 million children will miss out on vaccination, or 4.7 million people might not get access to clean drinking water, or nearly 22 million missing out on emergency assistance. In the next year alone, as Plan International has calculated, the latest cuts to foreign aid could mean 220,000 fewer girls enrolled in school, 400,000 fewer girls immunised, 3,153 fewer classrooms where girls can learn will be renovated or built, 157,000 fewer girls will get better access to safer drinking water, or 750,000 fewer textbooks. To retain public support, of course, official development assistance must be effective, it must be efficient, but it also has to be argued for and defended. Now, in the 18 months since the election of the new government, we've heard a lot about this concept of aid effectiveness, as though no one had ever thought of it before. In fact, Australia over many years has built a highly effective aid program through our NGOs and through our specialist aid agency, AusAid. You only need to look at the many, many examples of life-changing things that Australia has invested in. Like in Timor-Leste, where we helped 30,000 farmers increase their crop yields by up to 80%, or helped 67,000 people get access to basic sanitation. Or the mobile courtrooms in Indonesia, where women could get marriage and birth certificates so that their kids could go to school, because they weren't able to go to school if they didn't have those proofs. Or the women in PNG who were able to take their goods to market because we did, listening to the local community, we did the most simple thing in the world. We built ablutions blocks so that women who were going to market didn't need to pee in the bushes where they would be robbed or raped. Positive findings in our own independent reviews were backed up by the most recent peer review from the OECD, which highlighted some of the strengths of our official development assistance program. The OECD found that we were increasing funding in line with our target to reach 0.5% of GNI. Our areas of good practice were increasing and the degree of fragmentation was decreasing. AusAid was singled out for praise for its strategic planning and the coherence it brought to key policy areas, and our focus on gender and disability inclusive aid was considered some of the best in the world. Aid effectiveness is not a new concept. Australia had a highly effective aid program, and it's the most recent cuts and changes that have made our aid program less effective. Abolishing AusAid meant a tremendous loss of expertise in the international development assistance delivery. As you all know, delivering aid programs takes a different set of skills from consular and diplomatic work. And as our record shows, the expertise, knowledge and experience of AusAid staff enabled Australian aid to be more effective and more efficient. It was a force multiplier. Australia needs specialists to design, run, measure and assess official development assistance programs and to build effective partnerships on the ground. Expertise allows us to go further than the simple platitudes that we sometimes hear, like give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day, teach a man to fish, he'll eat forever. We've heard people say that, government members say that, and it's pretty disappointing that that's as sophisticated as it gets. A more thoughtful approach would lead us to ask questions like, who's going to build and staff the school that provides the vocational education that teaches that man to fish? Who owns the cannery where he sells his excess catch? Does the cannery owner pay their fair share of tax so that that tax dollar may be reinvested in building more schools so that more people can learn to fish? Or do they need to be learning other skills as an economy changes and develops? What about the downstream industries? How sustainable is fishing in this area? Will an emphasis on fishing as a preferred trade lead to overfishing, fish stock exhaustion, and the collapse of the industry? Does the fisherman get a fair price, and what role can technology play in that? For example, there was a terrific article in The Economist a while ago in their special on Africa where they described the incredible penetration of mobile telephony, where Nigerian fishermen were actually phoning from their boats at sea, checking what the prices were for fish in the different ports that they could call into, empowering them so that they're not tied to the one buyer of their fish stock, but giving them options to increase their income. So proverbs and platitudes just don't cut it as aid programs grapple with these complex international questions of tax justice, strong governance, of inclusive and sustainable development. Of course every dollar counts, and Labor expects our international development programs, our NGOs, private sector partners, to have the expertise, the skills and the professionalism needed to achieve maximum value from our investment. But we've seen in our own lifetimes that goals that once seemed impossible have been achieved, like a polio-free India. But what you need is methodical and targeted effort. I believe that using our expertise with focus and with application, other seemingly impossible tasks are within the international aid community's grasp. And I think one of the most interesting changes we've seen is the change in focus from containing the HIV/AIDS epidemic, tuberculosis and malaria, to a belief that we can end these diseases. But I also know that when Australia once again has a government committed to taking official development assistance seriously, the sad truth is that the scale of the cuts that we've experienced means we'll be planting in fields sown with salt. Australia's government agencies have lost skilled personnel. They've lost experience and expertise. Successful programs have closed or are slated for closure. We've lost skilled activists in the community. Organisations, NGOs have lost staff as they can't afford to pay them anymore. And probably most damaging of all, we've lost a critical community consensus. It won't be a simple matter of releasing the pause button. We will need to rebuild from scratch. We'll have to concentrate on what we do well, where our investment will do most good as we rebuild our Australian aid program. We'll also need to be clear again about what our aid program is designed to do. It's our contribution to ending poverty. Aid by itself can't lift a nation out of poverty, but it is critical in creating the preconditions for individuals and nations to lift themselves out of poverty. the idea of a basic level of food, shelter and the support necessary to live rather than merely exist contains within it the understanding that no one can innovate or thrive or work to reform their government and institutions if all their energy must be ceaselessly bent on surviving each day. It's hard to learn if you don't have enough to eat, and it's hard to work if you've got malaria. Without addressing the crippling effects of poverty, other international development goals cannot be as effective as they ought to be. And I simply cannot understand a government that removes poverty alleviation as an objective of the Australian aid program, as our government has done. While trade is important for developing countries, the government seems untroubled by the prospect that the gains flowing from any increase in aid for trade may only trickle down unevenly, if at all. As we know, economic growth does not necessarily reduce inequality in nations, and you can see nations with very impressive growth, like Indonesia and Cambodia, where inequality is actually increasing. So it's vital that we maintain our clarity of purpose. Growth is good, of course it is, but not for its own sake. It's good because it can help people and countries overcome poverty, but we need to look at the character of that growth, not just the quantum. The partnership between government, NGOs and the private sector only works when it's built on predictability, respect and transparency. Unfortunately, in recent times, we've actually seen a decrease in our ranking on the Aid Transparency Index, an independent measure of how much and how frequently aid information is made available. Now, it's important to make that information available to avoid overlap and to enable long-term planning. The adoption of the Open Government Partnership, an international platform for domestic reformers committed to making their governments more open, more accountable and responsive to citizens, has also stalled. As you know, it's estimated that the value of aid dollars is reduced by up to 20% when funding is unpredictable and volatile. So the government's approach of successive cuts has meant not just a decrease in dollars for NGOs, but decreased effectiveness for the dollars they're getting. Just as they settle their programs and work out what they're going to have to cut and which staff they're going to have to lay off, the next round of cuts comes. In fact, NGOs have described signing contracts with the Australian government, contracting with local providers to deliver programs and then being told that the funding is no longer available. Successive waves of cuts mean that budgets, staff cuts, programs are never settled, but there is always a new round of retrenchment necessary. I began by talking about the benefits that we receive from foreign aid, the health, security and trade benefits we receive. But because Australia can't be secure in an insecure world, and poverty and inequality have throughout history been one of the great causes of insecurity. But there's another reason that we should help those in need. The reason that giving remains popular even when foreign aid becomes controversial. Our fellow Australians know well the voices that Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nation. We know the names of those angels: empathy, understanding, compassion, generosity. And of course, we hear those angels' voices most clearly when they come from people near us, when our own child is sick, when our own friend is hurt, when our own family is in hardship. But we hear those angels when they speak also on behalf of the stranger, the foreigner, the dweller in a distant land. We aid those in need, not only because of the security gain we have for ourselves, the benefits we reap, but also because they remind us that despite our differences, we share similar needs and aspirations, we feel similar fears and loves, and to turn our backs on that is to accept a narrower, cramped soul. Those of us who understand the importance of foreign aid, the importance of the role that government alone can play, the effect that foreign aid has on alleviating and preventing suffering, uplifting horizons and opening opportunities, have an obligation to build and rebuild ceaselessly that bridge between public understanding of the good of giving and our own understanding of the good of aid. No consensus is ever permanent, and the consensus for foreign aid is no different. It is, I know, a tiring task to make and make again an argument for something that just seems like common sense. But to turn away from that responsibility is to accept that narrower and more cramped Australia. Thank you.
Shadow Minister, thank you very much. You've kindly agreed to take a couple of questions, and we have a couple of minutes to do that. So I'm going to invite questions or comments from the floor first of all. When you ask your question, please identify yourself, and we have roving microphones, so please wait until the microphone reaches you.
Thank you very much for a very nice overview of the recent policies. My name is Terry Hall, I'm from the ANU. What I would like to ask about is, with all of these cuts, we know that we have essentially the quartermaster's call on cutting the budget everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is left in the aid project seems to also be subject to captain's calls and first mate's calls. And I wonder what you would say about that. Are these prima facie inefficient ways of managing the aid program?
Well, I think you're quite right to identify those problems, because it's the size of the aid budget that's important. It's also the certainty and predictability of it. And if you have a lack of clarity about how decisions will be made, how effectiveness will be evaluated over time, that it lessens the dollar value that you've got. You've also identified another problem, which is it's not just the aid budget that's been cut. There's the final 2 years of the Gonski School Education funding. There's over the 10-year projection, there's about $50 billion cut from the hospital system and $30 billion cut from school education funding. So there are other large cuts in other areas that will be priorities for a re-elected Labor government. So replacing the aid dollars will be in competition with these other areas too. That's why building a community consensus is a very important thing to do, to stake a claim for returning money to the aid budget. The thing that I think people actually don't understand the size of this problem. So $11.2 billion has been cut. That, if you even replacing $11.2 billion would be difficult. But the way that budgets work, you're looking at the four-year forward estimates from the time that you're doing the budget. And if we return to government and look at the four-year forward estimates, or look at trying to get to 0.5% when we originally hoped to, that'd be about an $18 billion one-off spend. I don't know if any of you have ever been involved in writing a budget. Well, I know a couple of people have been, but the task of finding that size investment is very difficult. But the necessity for returning both certainty and having decisions made independently by people who really know what they're doing, and that is something that we can do.
Thank you, Shannon Minister. I really enjoyed the presentation.
Thank you.
The question is to try and focus a little bit more on how we build that community. Oh, sorry, cooperative engineering. How do we build this community consensus? And I'm thinking there's scarce resources available in NGOs.
Yep.
Is it better? You hear also when the cuts were made, the comment from ministerial staffers where they were surprised how easy it was to cut the aid program.
Yeah, good for them. Lucky them, hey?
Lucky them. But what we do about it, I guess, yeah, is what's the balance between a general building of some of these broad views and success of aid to support the community consensus, or to what extent is there a need to be sort of hard-headed, possibly, and general resources into, let's say, the five most marginal seats to campaign on aid? Return to 0.5
in marginal. Okay, thank you. It's a great question. Look, a number of the aid organisations have been working separately and together on a campaign, and I think it's important that people support the campaign that the NGOs are running. Plan International's been doing some good work. Fred Hollows has got a great campaign, just being involved with sharing that information and any other campaigns that might come out. But I actually have always thought that, television advertising, that sort of thing, is less effective than messages that you hear from people that you know and care about. So the best way... I think the reason that the Make Poverty History campaign was so successful was because it was very localised. You had church groups, school groups, local community groups all campaigning with a very clear message. And I think that that's really what needs to be done here, a motivation and activating of the same type of people who cared so passionately and were prepared to organise in their own local communities around Make Poverty History.
Hi, Margaret McPeg from the Nostan Institute for Global Health at the University of Melbourne. I'm wondering what you think about the issues around causing colonies difficulties in doing reinstating housing.
I think the first and most apparent difficulty is that all the fantastic staff have gone got new jobs. So we've actually lost them. They've made a decision to go and live their lives, and that's really unfortunate. I don't think the problem with getting rid of AusAid, like, I don't care who does their computer systems or their payroll, the problem is losing those experienced people, and there will have to be a rebuilding process. There's no, flip the switch, everybody's back on board, I know you've been out for a coffee break, time to start work again. It just won't work like that. This is a medium term, at least, project to return that degree of expertise that we had and have lost. Thank you. And I'm sorry to rush off everybody, but,
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.